All right, Exodus chapter 7. You know that we're dealing with Moses. And Moses, of course, is God's great prophet, one of God's great prophets. And he is now standing before Pharaoh. For those of you who may not have been here, Moses hesitated at first. God called him out of the burning bush to go and to liberate his people Israel. And Moses kind of struggled with that at first. But now we're far past that. He has been given the commission. He's already appeared before Pharaoh once. And, of course, that didn't go very well from the standpoint of Pharaoh accepting God's word. God, through Moses and Aaron, told Pharaoh to let my people go. But he said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? He said, I don't know the Lord, and I'm not going to let his people go. And so that's where that stood. And in fact, what did Pharaoh do? Not only did he dismiss Moses without giving God what he wanted, what else did Pharaoh do? Is that the end of it? Right. He made it harder, their work harder. He said, you have to go now get your own straw. And so they had to, basically, they had their work doubled and had to accomplish. They had kind of a quota of bricks that they had to make. And he didn't lower the quota, didn't lower the time, just doubled the work. That was impossible. And so they were beaten by the taskmasters, and they complained, went before Pharaoh and complained about that. And then they met Moses and Aaron on the way out, complained to them. And so it really didn't go very well that first time. And then we find Moses and Aaron going before Pharaoh again and gave the sign of the staff being thrown down on the ground, turned into a snake. And then what happened after that? What came next? After Aaron threw that staff down, turned into a snake, what did Pharaoh do? Same thing. Right, his magicians came along and threw down their staff, and it turned into a snake. And that really impressed Pharaoh. Until what happened after that? All right, very good. So that was a demonstration that God is more powerful than the Egyptian gods. But that was just the beginning of that. We spent most of our time last week kind of introducing the plagues. Remember, we said that there are three reasons for the plagues. Like, God is God. If he wanted to, he could have put an end to this whole thing in a blink of an eye. He could have delivered his people anytime he wanted to. But instead, he went through all of the plagues, and we said, number one, it was for what? To glorify God, the glorification of God. And, of course, that continues to go on. Most everyone, even people who aren't Bible students, know about Moses and the Egyptians and the captivity and then, of course, the plagues and what God did. And so, number one, it was for God's glorification. Number two, what was the second purpose? The mortification of the Egyptians. Moses was a bad man. He had a hard heart. And he just wasn't a very good man. But the truth of the matter is, the Egyptians had a lot of fault. They were idolaters. They mistreated the people of God in many ways. And so God, of course, would have his vengeance upon them. And that's what the plagues really are all about. And the third reason, what was the purpose really of the first two? Israel's deliverance, the emancipation of the Israelites. And so we see that is the purpose of these plagues that we're going to be seeing. And so now we just get into the plagues. Again, there's not, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on each plague because most of it is self-explanatory. Keep in mind that these plagues really are judgment upon the Egyptian gods. And you might want to flip over to Exodus chapter 12. And at verse 12, I think we may have read this last week, but this kind of summarizes what it's all about. Exodus 12 at verse 12, he said, I will pass through. through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. And he is dealing specifically there with this final plague, of course, which will be the worst of them all, the death of the firstborn. But all of the plagues fall into that category. And so this is really judgment against the gods of Israel. In other words, God is demonstrating that he is far greater than these Egyptian gods. And so he wants everyone to know that. He knows that these Egyptians are not going to all of a sudden conclude, even by these plagues, that God is the only true and living God. These people and the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, they serve a plurality of gods. And it's just who they are, who people were. As I said, I think last week, that's who people have always been. And there's always just a few people on the face of the earth who don't believe in some kind of higher power. I mean, there are very few true atheists. And there are some, but compare, you know, when you start comparing to those who don't think like that, they're just a small number. Those who are atheistic, they have a loud voice, really. But there's not too many people who don't believe in a higher power. Did Pharaoh himself believe in gods? Absolutely. He, in fact, thought he was one. And so that was not the case. The problem that Pharaoh had was not with anything that Moses was demanding per se. It wasn't that there was something odd about the Israelites serving God or anything like that. Everybody served gods. The real problem with Pharaoh was Moses coming in and telling him that his God is giving him some kind of order. That was a problem for Pharaoh. Like, who is, I don't even know your God. And I'm supposed to listen to him? And when you stop and think about it, even today, there's very few true atheists. Most believe in some kind of higher power. They don't, a lot of people, they're kind of like the Athenians before they obeyed the gospel. They serve an unknown God. You know, most people serve a God. They don't know if it's a he or she or what it is. They believe in some kind of higher power. So that's not really the idea that we as Christians believe in God and give so much. We try, at least we all fall short, but we try to give so much of our lives to God. That's not offensive to people. What's offensive to the world is when our God tries to tell them what to do. They don't like that at all. People don't like the idea that there is a divine power that can give them orders. That's where people rebel. And, of course, we see Pharaoh is just like that, and he rebels every step of the way. Well, let's get into the plagues. Then at verse 14, Exodus chapter 7 at verse 14, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to water. Stand on the bank of the Nile to meet him, and take in your hand the staff that turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you." So now notice that he's leaving no doubt at all who's behind all of this. It is not simply Moses who is dealing with Pharaoh. It is God. And notice he says, and you shall say to him, the Lord God of the Hebrews sent me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But so far you have not obeyed. So this is God speaking to Pharaoh through, of course, Aaron and Moses. But these are the words of God. And somehow Pharaoh's under the impression that he has a choice in all of this. This is not just God making a request. He has given Pharaoh a command. And so this is kind of coming from God, a rebuke upon Pharaoh for his disobedience. And you notice the wording there that God specifically used. But so far you have not obeyed. And so telling us God is commanding him to do something, he's just not listening. And the only choice Pharaoh has is whether he's going to be obedient or disobedient to the God of heaven. And he's choosing to be disobedient, which we all have the ability to choose, don't we? Like, you can choose if you're going to serve God or not. Everybody has to make that choice. But you better know there's some consequences for the choices that you make, for the choices that I make. If we make the wrong choices, we're going to have to pay the price. Pharaoh makes the wrong choice. He's disobeying God. He has a free will. God is allowing him to do that. But as a result, his life is going to get very tough going forward until finally he loses it. And so today you can serve God or you cannot serve God. Or even those of us who are Christians, you can decide what kind of Christian you want to be. You can be sporadic in your service and your worship of God. You can be wishy-washy, or you can give God your whole heart. That's up to you. It's up to me. God doesn't force us to do anything, but we're going to have to live with the consequences of our choices. And never is that more on display than it is with Pharaoh as he deals with God. But so far, he has refused to obey. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. And remember, that's kind of an answer to the question. We go at the very beginning, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Well, God is about to tell him. He's about to demonstrate who he is. He says, behold, with the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall turn into blood. The fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile will stink, and the Egyptians will grow weary of drinking water from the Nile. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the canals and their ponds and all their pools of water, so that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, even in the vessels of wood and the vessels of stone. Demonstrating that there's no question this is miraculous. There's a lot of people who try to explain this plague away and say, well, you know, that could have all been caused by the red clay that was famous at that part of the world and on the riverbanks. Or there's certain plants even that gave off a reddish kind of a substance. And that's all that was. Well, how would that explain even water in wooden vessels turning to blood? That there's no question but that this is a miracle. And this is devastating to the Egyptians for several reasons. The Nile was their livelihood. Like the Egyptians, they viewed the Nile as being sacred. And you can understand, I mean, they needed the Nile to survive. It was their main source of water. And so, I mean, it was very significant. It was their main source of food. Their fish was one of the primary aspects of their diet. And so their economy rested upon the Nile. And so, I mean, it was very important to them. So they felt highly then about the God that they attributed to the Nile. The Egyptian god for the Nile was a god by the name of Abi, they believe that it was the god of fertility, because again, what would happen with the Nile every year? It would flood every single year, and then when it would recede, it would leave rich deposits of soil that was very fertile. And so they prospered a lot. They were very fruitful in Egypt, and they attributed that to the Nile. And so they would worship. They actually viewed the Nile itself as a god. We have record of different hymns that way back then that they sung and would really sing in worship to the Nile. And there were other gods. Remember, the Egyptians had so many. They had more gods than most cultures. like the Greeks, and you know, everybody had gods. But I think I heard today someone say, I didn't verify this, but someone said the Egyptians had 114 gods. I don't know if that is exactly right, but somehow he came up with that. Now, that's a whole lot of gods. When you start thinking about, like, you go through and look at the Roman god, the gods that they served, and, you know, there are always a plurality of them, but 114 is quite a lot. Like, they had a god for everything. And they overlapped, too. Like, they had more than one god of fertility. But they had a bunch of gods, and several were associated with the Nile. And so this God setting forth this plague and turning the water into blood would be devastating to them. And think about it from not only a religious standpoint, but just a practical standpoint. What would happen to us in this country? We woke up tomorrow and all the water was undrinkable. We would be in trouble, wouldn't we? Like, if that wasn't rectified, we would perish. And so this, you know, a lot of people think these plagues are just minor, and then, you know, just a little minor blow here and a minor blow there. And then finally the crushing blow at the end when all the firstborn died. And there's no question that last plague is the worst of all. But a lot of these plagues are devastating. This is disastrous for Egypt. Like it would be for us if we woke up tomorrow and didn't have any drinking water. I mean, that'd be terrible. And again, we read in here to where it says that that all the fish died. Now, we'll see at the end of this that this is, at verse 25, it says 7 full days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. And so that kind of implies, gives us the indication that this lasted for a week. And that's a long time to go without drinking water, isn't it? Raise your hand if you've recently gone a week without drinking water. I don't know how long. I mean, you can go a long time without drinking, but I mean, you just think about it. They're like any society. They had older people, some sickly people. It's not stated specifically, but I wouldn't doubt at all that there were some who died during this week period of time with no drinking water at all. I mean, this is a disaster upon Egypt. And God is just getting started. And it's all because Pharaoh has a hard heart and he just won't let God's people go. And so now this happens, and of course we do see here at verse 22, it says, but the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So we'll not try to hash that out again. We looked at that earlier, that these magicians could do some things. But again, first of all, isn't it clear that what they did was far inferior to what the God of the Hebrews did? There was barely any water for them to turn into blood. They had to dig, I think what verse 24 says, and all the Egyptians dug along the Nile for the water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. And let me tell you, even that was a act of mercy by God to allow them to have any drinking water. Could God have plagued that water too if he wanted to? Of course he could have. And so that was a blessing. But now think of what the common people thought, that these magicians are coming along, and if they had this power, what should they have done? Right, they should have fixed the water, but they didn't have that power. They couldn't undo what God did. Only God could do that. And yet, I mean, when you stop and think about it, taking the water, the little water that they have for fresh supply, and turning that into blood, was that the smartest thing to do? What do you think some of the common people think of? What in the world are you doing? We're dying of thirst here, and why are you doing that? So, I mean, even their acts themselves weren't very wise, but compared to what God did, that proves that God is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. no matter how you look at this. And so certainly Pharaoh then, with this great demonstration, is going to have a change of heart, but that's not what happens. He sees what his Egyptian magicians can do, and it says that he hardened his heart, or his heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them. As the Lord said, Pharaoh turned and went into his house. Now watch this. And he did not take even this to heart. And that's really an amazing statement. Like, Pharaoh, really, he is convinced. This is just what happens with truth in error. When people believe religiously, believe a lie, do they really believe it? Most people? Absolutely. They sincerely believe it. Like I've said through the years, I think we mistake when we conclude that there's people who may believe some kind of error or practice some kind of error that they're insincere and that, well, that's not the drive. I mean, listen, there are some insincere people out there. There's some insincere people in here. There's insincere people everywhere. But for the most part, people who have bought into religious doctrinal error, they believe it. They're convinced of it. And Pharaoh was too. It's amazing. Just this little act by the Egyptian magicians could persuade Pharaoh, well, all right, they could do it. There's no need for me to let these people go. There's no evidence for me to give in to the Hebrew gods. My people can do the same thing. Even though God was clearly superior. And that's just the way it is religiously. People who buy into error, people who are Bible critics and that sort of thing, they don't need very much evidence to persuade them of their beliefs at all. Like, that's kind of amazing when you think about it. They don't critique error nearly as much as they critique the Bible. Like, they'll spend hours trying to prove the Bible is contradictory. How much time do they spend looking at the fallacy of things like evolution and that sort of thing? They don't need very much evidence at all to be absolutely persuaded that they're right about the error that they have believed. And that's just the way it goes. It's kind of the way Pharaoh is. He's convinced. He goes into his house, and it says he did not take even this to heart. He didn't think. He went to his house, and he didn't even think, boy, that was, you know, you would think, all by himself, the privacy of his own home, he goes in there and says, you know, what am I going to do? This is getting serious. I mean, the God of the Hebrews, he turned water into blood, water from everywhere in the ponds and the canals and everywhere. He didn't do any of that. He went in his house, didn't give it a thought. What does that say about it? That's pretty amazing to me. And so that's where we are. So, chapter 8 then. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will plague all your country with frogs. Now you think about that. Look at the extent. The Nile shall swarm with frogs that shall come up into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and your people and into your ovens and your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come up on you and on your people and on all the servants. Now you think about that. That's quite a plague, isn't it? You think that's just a minor thing? Can you just imagine frogs everywhere? You go to bed at night. You can't roll over without rolling over a bunch of frogs. I mean, they're everywhere. They're in the bed. They're in the ovens. You sit down to eat, and there's a bunch of frogs on your plate. I mean, and that literal. They're everywhere. Now, the Egyptians, there are a lot of frogs in Egypt. So not like they're not used to frogs being around. When that Nile would go back, as I said earlier, after it would flood, it would leave pools and ponds and things, and there would be a lot of frogs, but not like this. They would know immediately, this is something supernatural. They couldn't do anywhere, go anywhere, but that they were surrounded by these slimy amphibians. And what do frogs do that we all know they do, and they do it all the time? They're always croaking, aren't they? Can you imagine these frogs croaking perpetually? They're in your ear, and they're everywhere, probably stepping on them, and they're just all over the land. And, I mean, that's a terrible place. Now, what made it worse is their religion. Because, yes, they worshiped even frogs. To them, frogs were gods or represented a god. The god of Habit was also a god of fertility. And in this case, it was supposed to protect women in childbearing. And so they would wear amulets and things that had the symbol of a frog on it, particularly during childbirth, because that was their religion. That protected them, made sure that everything would go well. And so the frog was sacred to them. So guess what they couldn't do? They couldn't kill a frog. Like, what would you do when there's a frog in your bed? What's the first thing you're going to do? Not me. I'm jumping out of bed and running. I'm probably jumping out of bed. But no, you'd kill that thing, wouldn't you? And you're stepping on it. You're stepping on frogs. They had to be very careful not to do it because the frog was sacred. So these frogs have miraculously multiplied. They can't get rid of them because they represent a god. What a mess people get themselves in, isn't it? All because of false religion. Do you think we have a problem with that? We're not so much unlike the Egyptians when you think about it. Not so much as worshiping animals, though there are some, no doubt, that do even today, and probably somewhere in this country. But what do we do when it comes to animals? Right. Isn't that the truth? Like, we all love our pets. You know, we love our dog. You all have dogs. You love your dog. Nothing wrong with that. But do people get carried away? There are, as Steve said, there are a lot of people who value animals more than human beings. There are people who value the bald eagle a whole lot more than they do the unborn child. Isn't that true? And you think of the jobs that are lost because we can't dig here, or we can't farm in this particular place, all because animal life. And I'm not advocating at all being cruel to animals or anything like that. But man sometimes forgets the order of things. There's some, don't go hunting. Don't hunt animals, because that is cruel. Why do you think God put the animals here? And we forget that. We get things mixed up. And so we have policies and set laws that aren't good for us. Nothing we can do about it because we have this obsession with animals. Kind of sounds like the Egyptians with these frogs. Nothing they can do about it because to them, they're gods. So they're all over the place. And so what a mess they have gotten themselves in. And so it says, and the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers and over the canals and over the pools and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. But the magicians did the same by their secret arts and made frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Now, again, that's just... I don't want to be too tough on these magicians, but was that smart? First of all, it didn't accomplish anything. I bet nobody but Pharaoh paid attention to that. The people, I mean, there's so many, there's frogs. We've already said there's frogs everywhere. Most people wouldn't even know what the magicians did. Not like all, you think the people, they did that and people said, oh no, a bunch of frogs around here. They're already in their beds and in their ovens and everywhere they turn. And so they just made the problem worse. And so again, if they had any real power, they would be able to undo what God did, but they couldn't do that. They didn't even try to do that. And so what they did really was, again, a waste of time and was useless. It says, then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, plead with the Lord to take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. And so he's kind of bending a little bit here, isn't he? It's getting to him a little bit. A bunch of frogs might do that to you. And so here he is. He's accepting that it is the God of the Hebrews who have brought these frogs upon them. It kind of reminds you of the fact that, I mean, one of these days, there's a whole lot of people that have the arrogance of Pharaoh. The same mentality, who is God that I should obey him? Guess what every single person is going to do at some point in time? Going to acknowledge God, just like Pharaoh kind of is right here. In just a little bit. But, I mean, obviously, when he goes to Moses and he says, you go to God and plead, that's an acknowledgement, isn't it? He's acknowledging that the God of the Hebrews is the one in charge of all of this. And there's going to come a time when every single person is going to acknowledge God. Every knee shall bow. Every tongue will confess. Everybody's going to acknowledge Christ and acknowledge God. Just like Pharaoh. People think, no, I never will. Yeah, you will, all right. Even if it's not until you stand before the great white throne and you understand who's in charge, everyone is going to bow. And such is the case with Pharaoh. But he, of course, has a change of a... Now, here's a remarkable thing, just quickly. It says, Moses said to Pharaoh, be pleased to command me when I am to plead for you and for your servants and for your people that the frogs be cut off from you and from the house and be left only in the Nile. Why would Moses do that? Why would Moses say, you tell me when you want me to do this? What would that prove? Right. That's exactly right. Like, it'd be very easy if God just did it for, you know how people are now, all right, the frogs are gone. And, well, that just kind of, it was just natural, it was nature taking its course. And, no, Moses is making sure no one concludes that. You tell me when you want me to plead to God to remove these frogs. And then if God does it at that particular time, then everybody would know he's the one doing this. Now, if you're Pharaoh and I'm Moses, and you have frogs all over you and in your bed and in your ovens and everywhere you turn and wherever you step, there's frogs. And I say, now you tell me, when do you want me to pray to God to get rid of these frogs? What are you telling me? Right now. No need to, don't go anywhere. Just go ahead and offer up a prayer right now. But what does Pharaoh do? What does he tell him? When does he tell him to do it? Why in the world? I don't know if it's ever explained or anything that's said about it. I don't know. But why did Pharaoh do that? I don't want to be too harsh, but, you know, sin can make us silly sometimes, can it? You see people involved in sin, and they do the silliest things. It's remarkable. We hear of senators and preachers and all kind of people who we know, some of them are intellectual giants, and they get caught up in some kind of scandal, and you think, like, really? What would make a senator with a Harvard education and has all these degrees and been a lawyer or whatever, and he's married and a happy family, got everything going for him, what would make him text another woman? The silliness of sin. It just makes you, it makes you do the dumbest things. Like, I can tell you right now, you know what? You're just begging to have your life ruined because somebody other than that woman you're sending that text to is going to see that text. Does it take a rocket scientist to conclude that? And you see them doing it over and over and over again. And that's just sin, the deceitfulness of sin. It makes you do dumb things. And if this wasn't an example of that, I don't know what else to make of this. Hey, Pharaoh, when do you want me to pray? Well, just do it tomorrow. I want to go back one more night and sleep with a bunch of frogs. And so tomorrow, you can pray to your God tomorrow. That just meant, I don't even know what to say. It's really something you can't explain. I don't know why he said that. But he did. He said, tomorrow, Moses, and be it as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. The frogs shall go away from you and your houses and your servants and your people. They shall be left only in the Nile. So Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord about the frogs, as he had agreed with Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses. The frogs died out in the houses, the country yards and the fields, and they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. And you notice the same kind of thing was said with the water turning into blood. Take a little mental note of how many times with these plagues it says the land stank. We'll talk more about that. So we'll start looking at the rest of the plagues next week.